Mount Meru, Sun, the Moon, the Four Continents.
As I've said the other day, it's not to clear our throats saying this prayer. In order to make this session of Dharma's discourse a meaningful and fruitful one, we are going to see that the verse of taking refuge and bodhicitta. And we're taking refuge in the three jewels until we become enlightened, which means particularly within the context of the Mahayana, in order to attain full enlightened Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings, please think this over and say this prayer of Ye bet so nam kin, draw la pinches, and yet over a shore, and yet your thoughts, so yet on my into the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly, I take refuge until enlightenment is attained. Through the collections of merit and wisdom, by listening to the teaching, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So say this three times. Prostration to the Buddha, who out of his compassion, moved by his compassion toward the holy Dharma, to rid us of all distorted views. So the Buddha, who was skillful and compassionate, since he appeared in India, it's been around 2,600 years now, according to the Theravada school. So during this time, it has become a very important religion in the world. The Buddha, the founder of Buddhism, is recognized in the world as an important founding teacher who is the teacher of non-violence as well. So today, when it comes to people using their intelligence to analyze things, investigate, and not just accept right away what they hear. Such people find the Buddhism to be, they take special interest in Buddhism, and therefore this teaching of the Buddha. People who are gathered here today, Tibetans and Himalayan people from the Himalayan regions, and also Chinese,
Vietnamese,
Korean,
Japanese,
and similarly from people from Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, if there are anybody from these countries also. And we also have Mongolians, inner and outer Mongolians, as well as the Mongolian, ethnic Mongolians from Buryat, Kalmyk, and Tuva regions of the Russian Federation. So for us, Buddhism is our traditional religion. So, of course, it's not good, right to attach, to be attached to one's, to have attachment to one's own religious tradition. So, of course, we are following our traditional religion, but being attached to one's own religion becomes, makes us rather biased, bear some kind of a biased attitude. Anyway, we have this traditional religion. In any case, it is, it helps, this tradition helps us to have peace of mind. So in our daily life, and particularly when we face problems, this tradition is something which brings a real peace of mind. Even non-Buddhists these days take interest in the teaching of the Buddha. So for peace of mind, peace and happiness in family, individual family and community, love and compassion, patience and so forth are important. And so all religious traditions teach love and compassion. And in order to practice this with a conviction, there are the theistic religions which also are meant for that. The greater your faith and devotion to the God you believe in, the greater, stronger your practice of love and compassion should be. So in order for that purpose, to cultivate, single-pointed to cultivate love and compassion, and the different philosophical ideas are also taught. So even if you may have some faith in the God or higher beings that you believe in, if you do not really practice love and compassion and make it rather as kind of a side, kind of a work, it's not right. So in order to promote or the practice of and development of love and compassion, there are the theistic religious ideas of Creator God, and on the other hand, we have the Buddhism, Sankhya, non-theistic Sankhya and Jainism believing, teaching the law of causality. And therefore, law of causality in these three traditions are considered very important, which says that if you do something wrong to others, then you will have the negative consequences, whereas if you do something good to others, then you will accordingly have positive consequences. And therefore, all religious traditions teach this. love and compassion. And since around 3,000 years, perhaps Sankhya's school of thought developed, and within it there is the non-theistic Sankhya. And since around 2,600 or 700, 2,600 or 700 years ago, the Mahavira, who the founder of Jainism, appeared, and he emphasized especially nonviolence. We can see even today the practitioners of Jainism, they really make the practice of nonviolence, not harming others, as the core of their practice. And we can see that they sometimes seem to be doing more than what we do in terms of this practice. And then Buddha appeared after him, and the crux of the core of the Buddhist practice is that love, practice of love and compassion. And in order to support that, then the Buddha taught the view of dependent origination. So this is a unique teaching of the Buddha, the view of dependent origination. So during the last 2,600 years or so, the Buddha first, in public, gave whether people have devoted to the Buddha or not, he taught. The first sermon he gave was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And that is like the big framework of the teaching. So this is the noble truth of suffering, noble truth of origin, the noble truth of true cessation, and the noble truth of the true path. So this teaches the nature of the Four Noble Truths. So all of us do not want suffering, but we want happiness. But how do we experience, how does suffering come about? So Buddhism doesn't believe in a creator God who is the doer or designer of our peace and pain and pleasure, nor do we believe in a permanent, unchanging course to give rise to suffering. But we believe or assert that causes and conditions bring about some result. And therefore, the Buddha taught the first two noble truths, which are the noble truth of suffering, the true suffering, and which is the result, and the true origin of suffering, which is the cause. And so, whether these pain and pleasure arise from some permanent unchanging cause or not, if you ask, no, they do not. And if you look at the cause, if they are produced by causes, for example, if we hurt somebody or harm somebody, the other person will be hurt, or there is discomfort created in the other person. And you also feel guilty if you fight with others or quarrel with others. So mad people are different, perhaps. So a normal person, if you have done something for a normal person, if you have done something wrong to others, I mean, you will not feel easy, at ease. And so harming others is something immoral or misbehavior. So this comes through unruly mind, undisciplined mind. The more you are undisciplined, the more it exhibits in your behavior. And if you are more disciplined, your actions will also tell. And so the physical and verbal actions are rooted in our mind motivation. And therefore the Buddha says, do not commit any evil, cultivate the wealth of virtue, and thoroughly subdue your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Now, in terms of subduing your mind, disciplining your mind, so if you have a very rough kind of a mind, You may be able to bring about some peaceful attitude within your mind stream. But in order to uproot all our faults, that's the biggest question. What should we do? So when we talk about the four characteristics of the each of the four, Four Noble Truths, all composites phenomena are compounded phenomena in the nature of suffering and impermanence, and all contaminated, impure things are in the nature of suffering, and all phenomena are empty of self and empty and selfless. So all our suffering, in other words, are rooted in our grasping at some independent self. But because things are self, without any self-identity, independent in existence and empty, as long as there is this ignorance which conceives independent existence and things, distorted view, then there's always going to be a counteracting factor for that. So although things do appear to us as if they have some independent objective existence, this distorted view always has its antidote. In the case of the climate or the weather, if the heat rises, then the coldness is diminishes, and if the coldness increases, automatically the heat decreases. So on the one hand, there is this distorted view which sees there is some kind of a self or independent existence, and on the other hand, the wisdom sees the lack of that independent existence. And so, since things are without any independent existence, the distorted view of self can be eliminated. It is not within the intrinsic, the basic innate quality of the mind. So due to certain circumstances, we develop hate, attachment, or anger, and so forth. But they do not stay permanently in our mind, as we know. If you look at love and anger, they also are opposites. So they do not arise in a single person, within the mind stream of a person at the same time, simultaneously. Sometimes you'll feel angry at somebody, at other times you have attachment also. Or therefore, these negative states of mind are not in the innate quality of the mind, and that there is an antidote to them. And that antidote has valid support of valid cognition, valid knowledge, whereas the other one, distorted view, which sees things to have some kind of independent existence. But if you really think closely over and over again, then you'll see that things do not exist the way that distorted view conceives. And therefore, if you eliminate this distorted view of self, then you'll be able to, there is a possibility to overcome it, and then the elimination of it is the liberation. And therefore, the Buddha taught the third and fourth noble truths, the noble truth of true cessation and true suffering, true path. And therefore, the Buddha also taught gave stated four qualities or attributes of each of these four noble truths. And so we should not leave the teachings, these kind of teachings on the four noble truths and its 16 characteristics just in books, but try to think over, reflect on them. I do that in daily life. When I recite Omarapachanadi mantra of Manjushri, so this is like the basic framework of Buddhism, which the Buddha taught during the first sermon. And so that was about the nature, stating the nature of the Four Noble Truths. So if that is the case, how do we use it in our practice, avoiding some certain things and developing others? And therefore, the Buddha said, one should know suffering and overcome the origin of suffering and actualize the true cessation, because we do not want suffering but happiness. And therefore, if regarding this true cessation, what it means, refers to, is the elimination of any amount of negative emotions or those defilements to be abandoned through antidote. And when you attain the purity or the elimination of that, you have cessation. And that has to be actualized, and that is to be done by cultivating the path. So the Buddha says, cultivate the path. And what is the purpose of that? The Buddha said, having understood when you have eliminated the root of the suffering and its causes, you have overcome the origin, and therefore there's nothing to be understood or nothing to be known. And then regarding the origin, there's nothing to be overcome once you have overcome it. And then once you have reached cessation, true cessation, there's nothing else more to be actualized, and then nothing also to be cultivated in terms of the path once you have crossed the path. So, of course, pain and pleasure come alternately to us. And then we have all kinds of problems also. So once you have eliminated all suffering, then you have reached eternal happiness. And so that is the result which should come through by applying the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, avoiding the overcoming two and then developing the other two. So, for example, there is this grasping at self, and so overcoming this grasping itself, you reach the cessation through the path. And these are based on the understanding of the two truths, the truth at the basis level. And when we look at the path, the Buddha says the cessation should be actualized. So how to see that it's possible for us to reach the cessation, and what actually causes leads to that cessation is taught more precisely and in detail in the second turning of the Wheel of Dharma. So the origin of suffering, which is grasping itself, is a distorted view, and so it's in ignorance. And therefore, what it is ignorant about is how things really are, selflessness. So the Buddha, right from the beginning, if he had taught that there's no form, no sound, and so forth, I mean, people might have thought that, oh, this is a teacher who teaches that nothing exists. But he led disciples rather in a gradual manner. So if there is some, if there are someone, I mean, if there are people who are interested in what is meant by this, then there are the teachings of the Perfect and Wisdom Sutras to understand how things exist, unlike how our distorted view perceives or conceives it. So those of you who are here for the teaching first time, who have not been to teachings like this before, please raise your hands. Among the monastics, anyone? So many of them are from Tibet, perhaps. Where the Chinese audience?
Those people who firstly come here, who never been, who never listened, is another sort of at all. Raise hand.
So I don't see if you are down there outside. So you don't have to keep raising your hands. Like soldiers, until they're told to keep your hands down, put your hands down. So I usually jokingly tell that the Heart Sutra is something that the Buddha taught in the Rajgriha, in the Welcher mountain, amongst many different audience consisting of gods and demigods, non-gods, humans. So if you think about it, it seems it was taught amongst two beings who had pure karma, as Jizumila Repa has said, when to his disciples were Dakpol Haje, Gampopa, and Rechungpa. So Rechungpa was quite a tough student sometimes. So when he had been to India one or two times, and after one of these, so he had brought certain texts which belonged to the non-Buddhist tantric texts, and Jitumila Repa checked what kind of texts Rechungpa had brought from India, and when he found some of the texts to be concerned, related with negative spells. And Jitumila Repa actually burned those texts when Rechungpa went out to fetch water for him. And Rechungpa, when he came back, he smelled burnt peppers. So when he saw that the Milarepa had actually burned some of the texts, and so they had a quarrel, a conflict, a problem there. And so Rechungpa was unhappy and revolted. And so at that point, Jitumila Repa brought down hailstones, and Milarepa then... Rechungpa felt concerned about where my master went. So, of course, he was Milarepa's student, and he could hear the voice of Jitumila Repa, but he couldn't see him. And when he listened carefully, he found that it came from a horn. And when he looked into the horn, he saw Jitumila Repa there. And when he looked at the horn, when he saw it, Jitamila Repa, he found that the horn had not actually increased in size, and Jitamila Repa had not decreased in size. And Rechungpa tried to go inside. So this kind of thing could happen. To Milarepa could do that when when you have gained full control over your energies and mind. And so, similarly, in the case of the Vulture Mountain, it had not become bigger, nor the number of audience shrank. But he was the Buddha himself at that time, during the teaching Heart Sutra, was absorbed in this concentration called profound illumination. And then the Shariputra and Chandrasik, Avalokiteshvara, had discussion. Regarding Avalokiteshvara, who was a deity form of a disciple, for someone who was not able to see Avalokiteshvara at all, but could see Chariputra saying something, might think that Chariputra was talking to himself. And so, this kind of case is possible. So, at such a time when the Buddha taught the Perfect Wisdom Sutras, because it was not in public, it was not recorded, historically recorded, and therefore there were people who say that this was not taught by the Buddha, and people say that sutras teach. Is nihilism. And therefore, later on, many great scholars have argued for Mahayana to be the teaching of the Buddha. So the Prajnaparamita, the Perfection of Wisdom's teachings, actually emphasized the teaching of the true cessation that was taught, firstly in the Four Noble Truths teaching. And then there are other teachings like the Tathagata Garbha Sutra and also Sandinimochana Sutra. So for those who were not receptive, who were not able to take literally what was taught in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, for their sake, the Buddha, regarding the teaching of which says there's no form, no sound, no order, and so forth, the Buddha kind of interpreted these teachings for such people who were not receptive, saying that he taught these with the three naturelessness in mind. Whereas the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, it's not the other sutra which is called Takten Nyingbu Tenpeto, which is to say the essence being permanent and enduring. Which is another sutra. So the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, regarding these three turnings of the wheel of Dhamma, the first turning of the wheel established the ground, framework. And then the second turning explains more on the cessation, which is emptiness. And the third turning of the wheel of Dhamma, Tathagata Garbha Sutra, teaches the path aspect, the subjective path of which meditates on the emptiness. And this is to lay the foundation to lead towards Tantra. In the Tantra, of course, in the three lower Tantras, they don't teach the subtle clear light. But in all four Tantra sets, there is this meditation on emptiness. When we do the sadhana practices, we say everything dissolves into emptiness and from within the state of emptiness. And so Highest Yoga Tantra teaches the subtle clear light mind and using it to meditate on emptiness. And so these teachings of the Highest Yoga Tantra were taught to disciples with the highest sort of mental faculty. And so the sequence of these teachings are like going through the school system. So there is the junior and then the middle school. So the first you need to go through the junior school and then the middle school and then high school and so forth. The Nalanda masters, the great scholars in with regard to the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, which are taught in the Pali tradition, and also the Vinaya, the monastic code of discipline, such as which teaches, which has the precepts such like how to wear the robes, wearing the lower robe in a round fashion, and then leading into the Mahayana. And so, Vinaya, the concentration, practice of concentration, and are similar, the practice of morality and concentration are shared in both the Sanskrit and Pali traditions. In the first chapter of Abhisamaya Alamkara, it is mentioned what the first chapter teaches is the 10 points, beginning with the bodhicitta. And then there are other practices such as kotrup and so forth, practice of armor-like practice and so forth. And so the Four Noble Truths taught in the first teaching of the first sermon, as well as the practice of morality taught in the Vinaya. And then you go into the in the Professional Wisdom Sutras, the extensive path of the Bodhisattvas, as well as the emptiness, and then the six perfections and so forth are also taught. So in the Professional Wisdom Sutras, what Buddha says is, teaches emptiness on the basis of, which are established on the form and so forth, and then how to go about with the path, and then the result, how you attain the result. And then, therefore, the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma, as I said yesterday, you need to establish emptiness or the lack of true existence, independent existence in things through reason. So because there is every chance for people to misunderstand the teaching of selflessness, and misunderstandings and misconceptions could happen. And therefore, Master Nagarjuna and other masters, like Nagarjuna wrote his six treatises of emptiness, on emptiness, and then as exegetical texts commenting on the third turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is the Tathagatagata Sutra and so forth, and he wrote the hymns, the collection of hymns. So, of course, understanding the Four Noble Truths in a rough fashion, you don't need perhaps to understand, you don't need the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, but to understand the Four Noble Truths in greater precision and in greater detail, you need the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And therefore, Master the Lord Maitreya and Master Sangha and so forth commented on the explicit content, the implicit content of the Perfectional Wisdom Sutras, whereas Master Nagarjuna and his disciples and followers commented on the explicit content of this Perfectional Wisdom Sutras. And then also the Master Asanga and so forth emphasized the Chittamatra philosophy based on the Samdhi Nimochana Sutra. In other words, the Nalanda masters have actually given written many texts as compared to the Pali tradition scriptures. The Sanskrit scriptures are much more in number. And then there is the Tantra, and particularly the highest yoga tantras is based on the teaching of clear light, the subjective clear light. But the Buddha Dharma declined at some point after the Buddha had passed away. But gradually, from the Nalanda institution, great masters like Nagarjuna and so forth appeared, and they, Buddhism in general, and particularly the Sanskrit tradition, they studied and commented. And in Tibet, Tisung Detsen, who is also known as the religious king, Tsangpalhai Metok, although Tibet already had familial relationship with China since the time of Songtsen Gampo in the 7th century, with his marriage to the two princesses of China, Wen Qin Kongzhou and the Bhrikkhu Ti from Nepal. And therefore, the two sacred statues also were brought with them to Tibet. And so we already had, Tibetans already had, from the 7th century, this familial relationship with China. But with regard to Buddhism, explained through reason and logic, the Tibetan emperor Tisung Detsen saw that this is the best tradition that we could import to Tibet. And so he invited Chandrakshita, who was already in his 70s, when he was invited, given the invitation, and he very kindly accepted the invitation and went to Tibet. So the Bodhisattva, great abbot Bodhisattva Chandrakshita, was a great master. And so amongst his writings, there is something called Tatuv Samgraha Prakarana, which is about Tantra, and therefore it's very clear from this that he was a practitioner of Tantra. So he came to Tibet in the 8th century. One time in Mongolia, when I went there, in a huge playground, I taught the short, concise Lamrim, the Song of Experience by Jetson Kapa, and at the end, when I had finished one page and put it on the table, it was blown away by the wind. So I asked people to actually look where it was going, and so Finally, I got it back. This was the text the text I was using was actually the one that I brought from Lhasa when I fled Tibet. So in Lhasa, there is this saying that on a high mountain hill, I mean, on a high hill, I went to offer incense offering, and but my scripture, my prayer book was blown away by the wind, and I don't know where the pages are. So regarding the Tibetan history, the Tibetan king, Tisung Dertsen, was someone, a visionary person who could actually see, have a very far-sighted vision. So he could have, of course, invited the scholars and teachers from China itself. But because we have this saying, I mean, in accordance with the saying that we should go back to the source of the water, the head of the water, and therefore the first 77 Tibetans were given the monastic ordination in order to test whether Tibetans would be able to keep the Vinaya vows or not. And it was successful. And in the beginning, when Buddhism was being established on the Tibetan soil at that time, there were lots of opposition from humans as well as non-human spirits and so forth. And what we are talking about here is that the teaching of the Buddha had gone through many ups and downs. And today, after Buddhism had spread and it was established in Tibet and it spread, we have kept the Nalanda tradition and particularly the teachings of epistemology. It seems we, the Tibetans, are the only ones who have preserved and promoted this tradition of the Nalanda, particularly and China, Japan and so forth. We all, I mean, all of them also follow the Nalanda tradition, the same tradition that we do follow. Tangshan, Xuanzang, perhaps. His tradition, he was a follower of the Dharmapala, Nalanda master Dharmapala. So even today, the Chinese practitioners and scholars are quite familiar with the Sandhi Nimocana Sutra. And Mula Madhyamaka Karika by Nagarjuna is also translated in Chinese, but it seems the Prasanapada commentary by Chandrakirti is not there in Chinese translation. And so the reason why Chandrakirti has detailed explanation of the Purnamadhyamaka Karika is because of the objection from Bhavviveka to Buddha Palita's commentary. And Chandrakirti goes over those criticisms and rejects or refutes them. And so because of these kind of challenges, the things have become more clear. And so if we look at Buddha Palita commentary by Buddha Palita, it's very inspiring, but there's not elaborate explanation in it. Whereas if you read Chandrakirti's Prasanapada, it's very detailed. And also Bhavviveka's the commentary, lamp of wisdom. It's very detailed explanation. So in these texts, when Tibetan masters commented on the Indian texts, They usually treated the text in three outlines. Rejecting or refuting others' positions, establishing one's own position, and then again doing a rebuttal of criticism of others. So if you could study these three texts together, we could see the details of where the challenges and the debates had gone. And the points become very clear to you. So this Prasanapada is not translated in Chinese. And then next, later on came Master Adisha, who was from Vikramalishila. When he came to Tibet, Tibet was already in a decline, a degenerated situation because of the killing of Tirebachan, because of some family problem or something. And then the bloodline, Tibetan emperors went to the two upper regions of Tibet. So during the time of those three great emperors, they have done a great deal of made a great contribution to the Buddha Dharma. But Lama Yeshivu went in search of gold in order to make offerings to the Indian masters to invite Master Adisha. And so Buddhism had also declined at that point. And Changzhubu gathered some gold, and he went to the Karlo Gyabo, the king who had actually arrested his uncle, Lama Yeshivu, and imprisoned him. And therefore, as it is found in the Lamrim text, in relating the stories, Lama Yeshivu was in prison, and he was already quite old and very weak physically. And so when Changzhubu saw him, Changzhubu told him, Lama Yeshivu, I'm going to pay gold in ransom in order to release you. But someone's just joking that he would bite the mic if it's too close to his mouth. So it's quite a sad. So you told that don't lose your heart. I have found gold equal to the size of your body, the height of your body, but I am just left with a gold equal to your head. So I'll find that soon and come back and release you. And Lama Yeshivu told Changzhubu, don't think of releasing me from the prison. I will not live long now, but from life after life, we go through the process of birth, aging, sickness, and death. But dying for Dharma is meaningful, and therefore, for the sake of Tibetan people, even if I have to give up my life for the purpose of inviting Georgia Adisha, I have no regret. And so when he heard it, Zhang Zhiwu, of course, was a nephew. So when he found Dalai Lama Yeshu's determination for the Tibetan people and the Buddha Dharma, he felt rejoiced and also sad. And so he cried a lot. So when he asked Nakso Lotsawa to go and invite George Adisha, he told them while crying, and Nakso and others could not decline that request, and therefore they went to India and Halama Ishii, the uncle, told Zhang Zhiwu that you should make sure that George comes to Tibet, and you should also relate my story that I have forsaken my life for the Dharma and Tibetan people. Relate this to George. So when the request came, George Adisha said, "Your Tibetan kings were king was a bodhisattva, and it's not right to decline the request of bodhisattvas." And so, Adisha was someone who was taken care of by Aryatara, and so she prophesied that you would be able to serve the Buddha Dharma and beings very well in Tibet, and particularly with the help of Upasaka, a layperson with a vow, the Buddha Dharma will be served well in Tibet. And therefore, in Turling, Zhang Zhiwu told Master Adisha, "We are not in a hurry to receive profound, deep teachings or very vast teachings, but please say, teach something which is going to be helpful for the Tibetans, and therefore, a short teaching." And therefore, Master Adisha wrote the Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment, which is, of course, draws the practices from the different scriptures. But it was written in a form which helps three types of beings. So it is a teaching which could be practiced by a single person in one sitting without mixing up or confusing the stages or the order and the number of practices and so forth, called beginning with the initial practice, leading, culminating to highest enlightenment. So someone with faith in the Dharma and understanding the Dharma, particularly having studied done the study of Prajaparamita, and in essence, the essence of the teaching is referred by this Heart Sutra mantra, leading one, a practitioner, how to go about with the practice, progressing along the path of accumulation, preparation, seeing, meditation, and normal learning. And so this text actually summarizes, so unless you have a broader understanding of the whole range of path. I mean, just focusing on Lamrim itself would not give you the complete idea. So, of course, I'm not going to read Lamrim Chemo, the great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment, but I have brought it down with me today. So when one time in Zhang, in a monastery in Zhang region of Tibet, there was a long life offering puja offering for me. So at that time, this text was offered to me. So I consider this very sacred and precious for me. And so this is the text that I brought with me when I fled Tibet. So I'm not going to read the Lamrim Chemo, but it will be. I'll just put it here. And so when you actually read the insight section, penetrative insight section of Lamrim Chemo, then you will see the weight of the teaching of Lamrim, the profundity. And as Nagarjuna says in Muladhara Karika, the Buddhas give teachings on the basis of two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. And it is said that the Buddha's teachings are based on the understanding of the dependent origination. And also in the Bhavana Karma, it says that all the teachings of the Buddha are either proceeding towards or leading to or landing at the suchness. And so I usually tell that when you teach people, you should start with the insight section of Lamrim, if you're teaching Lamrim, because when you understand the two truths, the conventional ultimate truth, then you'll understand that cessation is possible through the cultivation of the path. And then you will have a strong faith in the Buddha Dharma. And then, of course, taking refuge makes sense when you say, I take refuge. I seek refuge in the Buddha Dharma and Sangha. Without really being able to move yourself through reason, I mean, it's very difficult. So understanding the two noble truths, on the basis of which if you teach the four noble truths, then it's going to be really meaningful. And so even someone who does not believe in the teaching, I mean, will not be able to go against the teaching. As I have written at the end of the 17 Nalanda Master's praise, by understanding the two truths, the ground reality, and leading to into the full understanding of the Four Noble Truths. May I gain an understanding of the teaching of the Buddha. So it's important for us to understand the two truths. So the system of teaching Buddhism, beginning with the colors and so forth, the collective topics, and then into the my study of mind and so forth, leading into the higher studies of Buddhist philosophy, is a very good tradition that we have as in Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Therefore, it's very important for us to try to practice the teaching after having studied all of them. Otherwise, having set for Geshe examination, instead of doing practice of the Dharma, what has become of us monks is that they seek dollars, money, and go to America and so forth. And in Tibet, inside Tibet, there are people, I have heard that there are people who are called Cha Lama in Chinese, false lamas, false teachers, who pretended to be teaching, ostensibly teaching Dharma, were actually seeking money and sex. So, if you find someone who is able to teach the Dharma as a qualified teacher, as the qualifications are given, the 10 qualifications given in Sutra Alamkara, then you should consider the person to be a qualified teacher, otherwise not. So you the disciples themselves, the Chinese, you yourself have to check those lamas, whether they are qualified or not. As Master Tsongkhapa mentions in Lamrim Chemo, in the section on relying on a guru, the qualifications of, he goes through these three outlines, qualifications of the guru, the qualifications of the disciple, and how the disciple seeks the guru. And relies on the guru. And Swahya Pandita says that people are very serious when it comes to checking the quality of gold and precious metals and precious jewels and so forth. But when it comes to the Dharma, people jump to them, the conclusions right away, as if a dog meets with meat. Whereas in Tibetan society, there is this custom that people do not value the geishas and the learned people, but when someone has the name of a lama or reincarnate tuku, then they actually value them, although they don't have any knowledge. So far, I mean, we cannot stay where we were. We need to change. In samsara, we are bound by our self-cherishing attitude and our grasping at true independent existence of things. So we need to see where the drawbacks are in us, where the shortcomings are, and then move forward. So we should develop that. The principles of bodhicitta and the understanding of emptiness. As it's not enough for us to consider that we are following just customs by reciting mantras and so forth. If we cannot do anything about studying the Dharma and so forth, of course, there's nothing we could do. But if we must study the Dharma. And so this is how we should go about with the Dharma, having studied them, to integrate them within ourselves. And so within the Lamrim tradition, there are the three Lamrim lineages, Mengakpa, the instruction lineage, Lamrim lineage, and then the scholarly lineage. And so there are eight great Lamrim texts which are taught for guidance. And together with it, we are here gathered to complete the rest of the text. I'm left with 500 pages, which must be finished within 10 days. So I will try to finish. So last time in Shamar Lamrim, we stopped. No. So we stopped at cultivating the root of all pleasure and goodness, faith of confidence. But before that, we'll go through Namdru Lakshan, the liberation in the palm of your hands. We are on the 11th chapter. Eleventh day. Day 12. Page 322, it says, told us we should adjust our motivation, our motive. The great Play Sutra says the three realms are impermanent as autumn clouds, being die, Beings die and are born. It is like watching a play. Beings like run. Lives run like lightning flashes in the sky or rush on the sky. High mountain, waterfalls. In other words, the three realms of... and so forth. And then the outline, thinking about what sort of happiness or suffering you will have in your next rebirth in either of the two types of migrations on page 322. So here the contemplation on suffering of the upper realms will come later in the medium scope. I'll now discuss the suffering of lower realms. You'll surely die, but it is not certain when. After you die, your consciousness does not end. It must definitely take rebirth. There are only two places in which it can take birth, the upper and or lower realms. As there is the Kadamba saying, what you have done in the past should be judged from your body, what kind of body you have, what you will be in the future should be judged, what kind of... what kind of motivation and thinking you have now in this life. You can assess inferentially to which of these two you will be going. So the comment was here and made here. As I have already said, we get divinations and horoscope made to tell us where we will be reborn next, but these are unnecessary. Buddha has already predicted that we will go to the upper realm if we have been virtuous and to the lower realms if unvirtuous. Now, from the Jataka tales, be quite certain your birth to the next world will be happy or unhappy according to virtuous or non-virtuous karma. And so with regard to the past and future lives, so there are two things, we inanimate and inanimate objects. So those who are animate have experience of pain and pleasure, whereas without these experiences, they are inanimate. So if you look at the flowers and like sunflower and so forth, so they kind of move according to the called face the direction of the sun in the morning to the face that these flowers face the east, and then as the sun moves, it moves, and there is one grass which is called touch me not, I think. If you touch it, it just shrinks. In Mysore or somewhere, there was one person named Guncho Samden. He told me that it's called the Ngotseza or the Za, which shows that it's shy. And in America somewhere, there is something like a thorn. And when people go quite close to it, it just shoots forth. The plant kind of shoots there. So if we are not careful and not able to shirk that, I mean, it's quite, it could be quite terrible. And so generally, there are two types, animate and inanimate objects, animate sentient beings and inanimate objects. So the things come from causes and conditions, within the causes, substantial causes and cooperative conditions are there. The cooperative, the substantial cause refers to those which actually turn into the result or the effect, the causes. But when it comes to the subtlest particles of our bodies or the external objects, they are same. So, after what kind of conglomeration of those particles do they actually become some support of life or not? We should really check. It's something the scientists could check. So even the inanimate objects have to come from a similar cause that can give rise to it, them. And also our body, when we, if we trace the origin, I mean, the, we can see that it started with Big Bang, the Big Bang, that in turn, which in turn could happen because of causes and conditions. And the explosion at Big Bang could also happen because of the energy. And those energies should come in their substantial course. We should try be able to try, trace them in previous particles. And therefore, if we go on like this, tracing the origin, it's we could say that it's beginningless. Otherwise, if you say there's a beginning, that's the beginning, then you would have to say some incompatible cause, like a permanent, unchanging cause, gives rise to this. So within sentient beings, we have the consciousness or mind, which is not material, doesn't have shape or color. It's mere experience and awareness, has this quality of being awareness and a clarity or luminosity. And therefore, regarding its course, there could be cooperative conditions, like when we have the eye consciousness and ear consciousness and so forth, there are these organs which also serve. Whereas the mind or the consciousness itself, for example, at the time of conception in a mother's womb, because it has its own substantial cause, you should have, we could only point to a previous moment of consciousness. As the Dharmakirti says, something which is not consciousness cannot be a substantial cause of consciousness. So the cause also has to be some similar in nature. So I was one recently in Nasik, near Nasik. I know one Hindu Swamiji. He's a learned Swamiji, and he even is familiar with the Mulamadimaka Karika by Nagarjuna. And Samdon Rinpoche also I took with me. And I asked him, what is the reason to that we have the three planes of existence, desire realm, form realm, and formless realms? And then I asked him about past and future life. How do we prove that? And he said, because we have memory. So amongst his students, he said, there is one person who has a very clear memory of past life. And so he said that the memory could be used to prove that there is a previous life. And also in the 400 verses of Aryadeva, the same thing is said. So if you are if you look at the teaching of the teaching of the Buddha in an unbiased manner, then you will see that there's at least something that we can think about. It makes sense. Even amongst between two a twin of this, there's no same thought process going on in the two persons. Of course, because of the biology itself, the physical, biologically, of course, we may be able to see differences in people. But I have a scientist friend, he's no more with us, he said, there are 6 billion people on Earth. And he said the neurons of each and every one of the 6 billion are different, the structure of the neuron, and therefore there is the different difference in our thoughts. So when it comes to the subtle particles, of course there are differences. But when we talk about whether people have luck or not, we do say it's because of good luck or bad luck that we have, but this alone cannot explain everything. So sometimes we find that things are almost like accident, but there are other factors. So I've asked scientists when a perfect semen and a perfect ovum get together, is it sure that conception will take place? They said no. So a perfect without any defect, a sperm and the mother's womb, without a perfect mother's womb and a mother's ovum, even if these causes are there, it's not certain or sure that a conception will happen. And therefore, there should be a third cause. According to science, of course, they are not able to posit that third cause yet. But for us, we can think about the bardo being who would conceive in the mother's womb. And therefore, there's more reason for past and future life. If you to assert that there's no past and future lives, I mean, the ultimate reason that you people may give is because I don't see them. But that's not a good reason, because if you were pressed, if something exists, is it necessary that you should see it? Of course not. And though it's very difficult to hold up to this position, So far, what scientists have not found is only the case that they have not seen them or found them or discovered them. It's not the case that they have found what they have not found to be non-existent. So it is said in our text that while we are at night time, the continent, northern continent of Kuru, is it's time of sunshine there. So it's almost like pointing to America, but that's not the case, because the people of the Kuru region continent are said to live for 1,000 years. And then with regard to Mount Meru, of course, it goes against reason. And when we deal with the logic of non-observance in the Pramanavartika, there are two types. One is if something is perceptible but it's not perceived, then if something should be perceptible but not perceived, it cannot be perceived. And so this is the logic that we can use to disprove the existence of Mount Meru, because it's supposed to be existent, but we cannot see or find it, observe it. Whereas with regard to the size and the distance of the moon and the sun from the earth, there's huge difference between what is taught in our classical texts and also what is taught, what the scientists find today. So in the classical text, it is said that the height of the moon and the sun from the earth is, regarding this, it is said that the sun and the moon go around the Mount Meru, around the halfway of the height of the Mount Meru. And then with regard to the sides, it mentions only the difference of one league or yojana between sun and moon in sides. I mean, this cannot be as accepted today. because it goes against our empirical experience. So we need to still think about the rams, the godly rams and so forth, which are said to be on the Mount Meru and so forth. And then regarding the lifespan of people, human beings on this earth, it is said that in the beginning it used to be inconceivable, and so and then there's a decrease in the lifespan. So perhaps it should also be interpreted. Unless we can explain that they had a different biological, I mean, a physical body than we have. So, with regard to the lifespan of the people on Earth, it's also said that it decreased to 6,000, 60,000, 20,000, and so forth. I mean, 80,000, 20,000, and so forth, which we have to rethink.
We are reading from page number 326. And the text liberation in the palm of your hand. The text is
the
revised edition. People born in this hell are sentient beings. We have taken rebirth here under the power of evil karma. When these sentient beings see others, they immediately get angry. Anything they pick up turns into a weapon. They keep hacking each other to pieces, all faint and collapse on the ground. Then a voice from the sky tells them, "You will now be revived." A cool wind strikes their bodies, a contributory factor for their scattered flesh and bones to come together. Their bodies heal and become as they were before. Then they do the same thing again. Every day they fall into these death faints. Every day there are many hundreds of these deaths, and they are revived many hundreds of times. We must develop insight into what it would be like to be born there now, to be hacked by weapons, to faint, to be revived, and so forth. In this life, we are afraid to be stabbed by a small knife and die the once, and we still suffer inconceivable terror and pain. In this hell, we will die many times each day and would experience this each time. Is there a fan? It would be nice to have a fan at the backside. Continue reading from page number 327. In this hell, we would die many times each day and would experience this each time. In our lifespans, there will be also be very long. Our former human lives would bear no comparison. Nagarjuna said in his letter, it's be too cold on this side, so the other side, please, on. Actually, sorry, I'm two pages ahead. His Holiness is reading from page number 325. The hell of continued resurrection is 32,000 yojanas under Bodh Gaya in India. So this statement is actually something that we need to investigate. According to this text, if we measure it, I think we will reach America directly. We're reading from page number 325, the last para. The other hotels are below this hell with 4,000 yojanas between each of them. All the ground and all the mountains in these hells are composed entirely of red-hot, intense burning iron, the ground like that in the human realms, and not at all flat, not at all like the palm of your hand. When you are about to be born into hot hells, as Gongda Rinpoche says, human life is impermanent, a short bout of sleep, crowded with meaningless dreams, some happy, some sad. When you suddenly awaken to a life in the pit of lower realms, what will you do? That is, at the point of death, you have hallucinations of being cold, so you develop a craving for heat, which activates karma, leading to rebirth in hot hells. You die, this is like falling asleep. You experience the bardo as old a dream. Then you suddenly find yourself in the hot hells, which is like waking up. Hellfire is seven times hotter than fire in the human realms. Let us compare these two types of fire. Human fire is so cold compared to hellfire that it is like water cooled by Goshirsha sandalwood. So the suffering of the hot hells in general are quite unbearable. The suffering of having a body, the thing being burnt, that is enormous. The suffering of having flesh with as little tolerance as a newborn child's. The suffering that the whole suffering that the thing doing the burning, the fire is extremely hot, and so on. There are eight such hot hells. There are no hell gods here. People born in this hell are sentient beings who have taken rebirth here under the power of evil karma. We have already read this page. Turning to page number 327, the last para. The assembled and be crushed hell. Be crushed hell. Rebirth here is usually the ripening of killing. Two mountains resembling, say, goats or ram's head. Heads raised together and you are crushed between them. There is no avenue of escape. The two mountains separate and your body regenerates to its former state. The process is repeated again and again. Some beings are ground to powder between green stones. Some are pounded with pestles like sesame seeds. Some are squeezed in iron vices. You could be crushed or whatever, between many different instruments. These take the form of whatever killing instrument you used in the past. Suppose you kill a louse between your fingernails. Later in hell, you will be killed by being crushed between two mountains that look like fingernails. The hell of lamentation. You are placed inside a house of burning iron. It has no doors and it is all on fire, inside and out. You suffer, thinking, I will not find any means of escape. Your great mental suffering makes you wail. The hell of great lamentation. You are placed in an iron house which is contained within another, each similar to the one above. Your suffering is also twice as great. You think I may escape from one of these iron houses, but not from the other, and so you suffer. Committing the 10 non-virtues or recklessly drinking alcohol can cause rebirth in these hells. A sutra tells us much the same thing. Drink alcohol and you will be born in a place of lamentation. People who serve are born in its surrounding hell. The hotel, you are impelled on a flaming iron skewer that runs through your anus and emerges out of the top of your head. All your insides burn and you burn through roaring flames issuing from your mouth, eyes and so forth. You are cooked in huge copper cauldron of boiling water. Then your bones are reassembled, your body is restored to its former condition, and you are cooked all over again. The extremely hot hell. We're reading from page number 329. The second para. The hell without respite. In this hell, there is no chance to rest, and so the suffering here is greater than in all the Ebu hotels. When we burn rocks or iron in a fire, they become indistinguishable from the fire. The bodies of being born in this hell are similarly indistinguishable from the fire. One can tell that there are sentient beings in this hell only by the pathetic sounds they make. They are burned by 11 fires, the fires in the 4 cardinal points of compass, the 4 in the sub-points, the fire in the zenith and nadir, and the fire within their own bodies. They are like the charred wick in an offering lamp. Their suffering is limitless. We're reading from page number 331, the second para. Once reborn here, we must experience suffering until the results of the evil karma run out, for we will not be able to detach our consciousness from our bodies. Nagarjuna's letter tells us such sufferings are utterly intolerable. One will experience them billions of times. So long as the non-virtue has not run out, one will not stop living that life. The lifespans in the 8 hotels are very long. The shortest lifespans are those of being in the hell of continual resurrection. 50 of our human years constitute one day for the gods in the realm of 4 Maharajas. 30 of these days are reckoned to be one of their months. 12 of these months, one of their years. 500 of these years make a lifetime for being in the realm of 4 Maharajas. Yet there is only a day in the hell of continual resurrection. 30 of these days are reckoned to be a month in this hell. 12 such months make a year. A lifetime in the hell of continual resurrection is 500 of these years. One could say this is 1.62 trillion human years. The old woodblock edition of Manjushri's own words states that it is 60 billion years, but this is a printer's error. You should consult either the Meru Monastery woodblock masters of this text or Lamrims of Southern Lineage. Reading from page number 333, the last para, thinking about the sufferings of the cold hells. The cold hells are on a level with the hot hells and lie to the north, which is why this land of ours is very cold. The cold hells are separated from each other vertically by 2,000 yojanas. You may be wondering, in that case, the cold house could not be on a level with the hot house because the hot houses are separated from each other vertically by 4,000 yojanas. There may be 4,000 yojanas between each ground surface of the hot house, but each of the cold houses has snow-covered mountains that are 2,000 yojanas high, so the cold houses are in fact level with the hot houses. When about to be born there, you desire cold bodily sensations at the point of death. This activates the karma to be reborn in the cold hells. You experience the birth as if it were a dream. You are then reborn in the cold hells, which is like waking up. There are snow-covered mountains in these places, each many yojanas high. There is no light from sun, moon, fire, and so forth. It is so dark that you cannot see the movements of your own arms. The ground below is a glacier. A blizzard reaches on high. Between these two, a cold wind blows. There is no means of keeping warm, so no fire, no sun, no clothes, nothing. There are eight such cold hells, each one progressively colder. There is the hell of blisters, where you develop blisters on the day. Now we are reading from page number 335, thinking about the sufferings of the occasional hells. As Maitreya has said in the prayer, that may the sufferings of the lower realms be extinguished, and may they all attain higher realms. So for someone who do not have any idea about the higher paths and higher realms, it is a different case. But for other people, I think the best way to stop being reborn in the lower realms is by practicing compassion and meditating on bodhicitta and also the wisdom realizing emptiness. And I think that meditating on bodhicitta and so on is something that if we cultivate, is something that you can develop and you can generate within yourself. Continuous reading from page number 335, the final para, thinking about the suffering of the occasional hells. These hells are in the human realms, on the ocean shore, and so forth. At one time, some merchants invited Arya Chandrachita to accompany them to an island. He struggled behind the others and walked to the ocean shore, where there was a beautiful temple. The 500 members of the Sangha, they invited him inside. The monks quarreled at noon, but when noon passed, everything returned to normal. He asked for the cause and was told that it was the result of their not being friendly to each other at the noonday meal and fighting in the past when the teachings of Buddha Kashyapa were still in existence. The Arya also saw hell beings in the form of walls, pillars, pestles, ropes, brooms, water pipes, and cooking pots. Later, when Arya returned from his journey, he asked Shakyamuni about all this. We have already dealt with Buddha's reply concerning the pillar-like beings in the section on the preparatory rites. The pestle-like creature, however, had been a monk in the time of Buddha Kashyapa's teachings and had lost his temper and said to a novice, "You ought to be pounded like a pestle." The monk had become the pestle-like creature as a result of these insulting words. Kyabje Pabongka Rinpoche told how these beings had been experienced these things from the time of the teaching of Buddha Kashyapa till the present. Once there was a ship's captain named Kodikarna who had been born with an earring set with a gem for 10 million gold pieces. Captain Kodikarna had sailed away to obtain jewels. He fell asleep by the ocean shore, and other merchants went on without him. He awoke to find that a strong wind had erased the path, and even his packed animal, a donkey, could not pick up the scent. Kodikarna wandered around, unable to find the path. There was a house like a palace, and in it a man is surrounded by four goddesses. The captain saw that at night the man had such bliss, it was like that of the gods. But by day the house became burning, iron licked by fire. The women turned into four ferocious dogs. The man fell down on his face, and the dogs ate his flesh bit by bit. Then after the sun had gone down, things reverted to their former state. He asked the man what the cause was. The man said he used to be a butcher in the town of Stara, but on the advice of Arya Katyayana, he had taken vows not to kill at night. He had not been able to take these vows for the daytime, and this was the result. The man said he had a son in Stara who was a butcher. Kotikana was to give the son a message. You should not kill. When you give alms to Arya Katayana, you should dedicate the good virtues to me. As proof, the man told Kotikana he had hidden a pot of gold in the place where the swords were kept. Kotikana moved on. There was a fine house where a man and two beautiful women enjoyed the peak of happiness and bliss. But the captain saw it was quite the opposite at night, when the women turn into snakes and are at the man, starting from the top of his head. Kotikana asked the man why this was. The man said that when he was a Brahmin in Stara, he used to be an adulterer, but he took the vow from Katayana not to do this during the daytime. This was the result. He said, go and talk with the son I have in Stara and give Kotikana a similar message to the previous one to take back. And as proof, he told Kotikana he had hidden a pot full of gold under the stoop. Then the captain moved on further and saw a four-legged fawn, a hungry goose held of each leg. And Gyabje Pamwanga Rinpoche told the rest of this story. Reading from page number 338, the last para, thinking about the sufferings of the hungry goose. Manjushri's own words discusses animals first. Hungry goose have greater wisdom than animals, so are higher. If one way to teach Dharma to some hungry goose, they could understand it. Animals are dull and stupid. It is an inferior rebirth and a bigger hindrance to practicing Dharma than being a hungry goose. So the sufferings of animals are taught first. However, the swift path puts hungry goose first. Generally, they have greater suffering than animals. There are two subsections at this point, thinking of the general suffering of hungry goose under six headings: heat, cold, hunger, thirst, exhaustion, and fear, and thinking of the sufferings of particular types of hungry goose. Think as follows. At present, I have not been reborn in hell, but if I were born a hungry ghost, I would be so tormented by intolerable sufferings, heat, cold, hunger, thirst, exhaustion, and fear, that I would not even be able to recollect that I should practice Dharma, let alone actually practice it. I have not taken such a rebirth owing to the kindness of my gurus. What great merit I have to be able to meditate even perfunctorily on the Dharma of Lamrim. How lucky I have been. But we have accumulated in our mental streams much karma that will throw us into these rebirths. This karma is still powerful and undegenerated. We know it is beyond our present capacity to purify it all before we die. There is more, though. Usually our thoughts at the time of death are crucial. Sinners may have committed great sins during his life, but if they die with only virtuous thoughts on their minds, they will activate virtuous karma from a past life. If Dharma practitioners are angry, for example, at the point of death, their non-virtuous karma will be activated. Normally, the thoughts with which one has the greatest familiarity in this life will be the ones that manifest at the point of death. We have always had the strongest familiarity with delusions, the three poisons, so our non-virtuous karma is sure to be activated at death. One may be revolted by food and drink at death and feel, may I never hear the word food again. This would trigger off karma to be reborn as a hungry ghost by either attachment or hostility. You cannot be sure that you will not be reborn in the unfortunate state of a hungry ghost. In fact, most of us will be reborn as one. The Hungry Ghost rebirths are located in Kapila Nagara, the city of Hungry Ghost, which is more than 500 yojanas underground. This place is absolutely no grass, trees, or water. The whole ground is copper slack, as if scorched by the sun. The bodies and limbs of hungry ghosts are more ungainly. Their hair is matted on their large heads, their faces wrinkled, and their necks extremely thin and unable to support their heads. Reading from page number 340. They have huge mountain-like bodies and an uneven number of legs and arms, which are as thin as stalks and unable to support them. They have 100 times more difficulty in walking than old people do in our human realm. For many years, they have found nothing to drink, so there is absolutely no moisture in their bodies, no blood, pus, and so forth. Their muscles and veins are wrapped in their dry skin like a dry log wrapped in brown leather. When they move about, the joints in their arms and legs creak like dry wood or like two rocks tapping together, giving off sparks. Since ghosts have had no food or drink for hundreds or thousands of years, they have enormous suffering. On top of this, there isn't a place where they haven't been in search of food and drink. Their bodies are feeble, so they are exhausted. They are in terror of seeing Yamasujana, the king of the city of hungry ghosts, fearing for their lives. In the heat of summer, moonlight burns them, and sunlight makes them cold in the winter, so they have great suffering. Thinking about the sufferings of particular types of hungry ghosts, this has three parts. The ghosts with external obscurations. These hungry ghosts see water, trees laden with food, and so forth, for which they rarely stretch long distances, but when they get there, the things vanish. When some hungry ghosts reach them, the hungry ghosts are prevented from enjoying them by armed men standing guard. In addition to their sufferings of hunger and thirst, therefore, they also experience inconceivable suffering due to physical exhaustion and mental depression. Those with internal obscurations. These hungry ghosts occasionally obtain food, but it does not get past their mouths. Their necks have nodes in them that make swallowing food very difficult. Some ghosts have to drink rancid pus from their own goiters. As it says in the full version of the above-mentioned story about Kotikarna, the food they eat takes various forms corresponding to different types of karma the ghosts have accumulated, burning pieces of iron, green husks, pus or blood, their own flesh, and so forth. The ghosts must endure these unbearable karmic results according to whatever is their accumulated karma. Food and drink may go down some hungry ghost's neck, but it turns into boiling iron when it reaches the stomach, which, as well as not slacking their thirst, creates a limitless suffering. There is one type of hungry ghost that this sort of thing does not happen to, but their stomachs are so huge that the food doesn't fill them. Sheets of flame, the fires of hunger, come out of the mouths of some of these hungry ghosts. This will, oh, the whips is merely fire from the mouths of such ghosts. Continuously reading from page number 341, the second para. Those with obstructions from nodes. Once when Ananda was going about his daily business, he saw a female hungry ghost. She had three nodes in her neck, and she shouted the five kinds of terrifying words. Hungry ghosts of this type have a vertical row of three nodes in their necks, which causes them infinite suffering. His Holiness was commenting upon the order of the presentation of the animal realms and hungry ghosts. His Holiness was commenting that in Lamrim Chemo, the animal realm chapter is written first. However, to the liberation of the palm of hand, it's later. Continue with reading. Those with obscurations from nodes. Once when Ananda was going about his daily business, he saw a female hungry ghost. She had three nodes in her neck, and she shouted five kinds of terrifying words. Hungry ghosts of this type have a vertical row of three nodes in their necks, which causes them infinite suffering. Nagarjuna's letter says, hungry ghosts are also bereft of the things they desire. This gives rise to continual suffering, aggravated by most intolerable hunger, thirst, cold, heat, fatigue, and fear. Some have mouths as small as the eye of a needle, yet their stomachs the size of mountains are plagued by hunger, but lack the power to digest the smallest speck of food. Some go naked, through their bodies are but skin and bone. They are as thin as palm trees. Some are aflame at sex and mouth. Food put into their mouths is burned. Most cannot often even feel for food, nor purse, feces, blood, and so on. They touch their faces together and take rented piss from the goiters at their throat. Reading from page number 342. For hungry ghosts, in the two hottest months of summer, even moonlight is hot, the sun cold in winter, and trees become fruitless. And at the time of death, it's very important generally to have a good motivation and thinking about one's own motivation. So even if you're not able to shift and have such a good motivation generally, but at the time of dying, it's very important to shift the motivation. It can be done also by some of your friends who can whisper the virtuous words into their ears. Continues the reading from page number 342. Chandragho means letter to a disciple says, unending thirst, if they see afar a clear stream and wish to drink from it, they go there. Yet the water is mixed with old hairs, fish gills, and rank pus. The water is full of mud, blood, and feces. A wind whips of waves, and the spray is mountain peak cold. When they go to the green sandalwood forests of Malabar, these become burning woods, a field of sharp-tipped flames. Many burning fragments drop and gorge them with pokes. Even when they go to a lake, it's terrifying waves with dazzling foam at the crest. The water turns into a mirage of desert sands, a tormenting place with sandstorms swept by fierce hot winds. When the launched four thick storm clouds gather, they rain a fog of impairing iron debris upon them. Flinty diamond nuggets of golden color and orange lighting chains rain upon their bodies. While they are tormented by the heat, even sleep to them seems hot. When made pathetic by wind, even fire makes them cold. The intolerable ripening effects of karma completely blind them. They have various utterly mistaken hallucinations. Their mouths are as small as the eye of a needle, their terrifying stomachs and many yojanas round. Very dispathetic creatures to drink. Even the water of great oceans could not go down their cavernous gullets. These poisonous mouths would dry the water to the last drop. Kesang Gyatso, the seventh Dalai Lama, said similarly, stomachs like mountains, necks blocked, limbs as thin as grass, dry bodies covered in dust, joints give up sparks, their mirrors glance dry up rivers, always weary, tormented by hunger. May a shower of food, drink, and nectar rain down upon these hungry ghosts. We can't be sure that this time, next year, we won't be reborn as one of these hungry ghosts. The causes for such rebirth are being miserly with one's possessions, enormous covetousness, such great attachment to one's possession that one fondles them over and over again, preventing other people from practicing generosity, stealing from people's possessions, stealing offerings made to Sangha, abusing charity, and other forms of taking what is not given to you. Another cause is calling people hungry ghosts, and especially if you call a member of Sangha a hungry ghost, you will take rebirth as one yourself 500 times. When hungry ghosts of the type with obscurations from nodes receive a drop of water, it is due to their not having been miserly about giving water. In the past, the others do not have the fortune to enjoy any water. Acharya Bodhijana went to the realm of hungry ghosts. An extremely pathetic ghost with 500 children, gave the Acharya a message to take back to her husband when the Acharya returned to the human realms. 12 years ago, she said, "My husband left to search for food, and I have meanwhile given birth to 500 children. I have not had so much as a drop of water, and so I have undergone great hardship and suffering. Acharya, tell my husband to help me by returning quickly from the human realms with any food he has found." The Acharya said, "What if there are many hungry ghosts there? I won't know which is your husband." He has some identifying marks that set him apart from other hungry ghosts. He has lost one eye and one of his limbs is deformed. When the Acharya returned to the human realms, he saw some hungry ghosts. One of them was just like the ghost to whom he was to give the message. The Acharya told his story and gave the message. The hungry ghost said, "I've gone such a distance, but in 12 years, all I found was this food." He was holding a small piece of dry spittle with the claws of his clenched fist. This was his most prized possession. A monk who maintained his ethics spat this out and dedicated it. Many hungry ghosts fought for it, and I won. Unless we are careful, we can never be sure there won't come a time when we will have to make lunch out of dry fruits. We're reading from page number 345. 25 years after the mother of the novice monk Uttara died, he saw a terrifying hungry ghost. The frightened Uttara was about to flee in terror when the ghost said, "Don't run away. Who are you?" Uttara asked, and he replied, "My only son, I'm your loving mother, from whom you were born, reborn among the hungry ghosts, who have no food or drink. 25 years have passed since the time of my death. I have not seen any water. Where will I see anything like food?" The novice asked Buddha to dedicate prayers to her. Buddha used his skillful means, and when the ghost left that rebirth, she was reborn as a hungry ghost called Mardika, who was extremely rich. Her miserliness was 6 times worse than before, and she would not practice generosity. The novice persuaded her to offer Buddha a bolt of cloth, but she regretted the action and she stole it back. According to the story, this happened many times. Kyabjapabang Rinpoche told the story of a monk who had a beautiful saffron robe. He became so attached to it that after his death he was reborn as a hungry ghost wearing a saffron robe. These days, miserly people are praised at being clever, but miserliness especially is the cause for being born as a hungry ghost. We act in a miserly way, so it is almost certain we will be reborn as hungry ghosts next year, or at most in 40 or 50 years' time, that is, if we do not get rebirth in hell. Reading from page number 346, thinking about the sufferings of the animals, this is two sections, thinking about their general sufferings and thinking about the sufferings of particular types of animals. Animals experience 5 kinds of suffering: eating one another, being stupid and benighted, experience heat and cold, experiencing hunger and thirst, and being exploited or made to work. The sufferings of animals are the least of the three lower realms, yet in such rebirths they eat one another and suffer. Animals with huge bodies, sea monsters and the like, have bodies many yojanas long. Some sea monsters are types of fish, others are whales that are capable of swallowing them, and there are even whales that can swallow other whales. Many smaller animals infest the bodies of the monster and eat them. There comes a point when the monster can no longer bear this, and they rub their bodies on rocky mountains. This kills the parasites living on their bodies, and the oceans are made red for many yojanas. The larger creatures devour the smaller ones, while many smaller ones feed on the larger ones. though they cannot bear to remain there, they cannot even wiggle free of the spot they live on. The animals of the great oceans are heaped on top of each other and must live with one eating the other from the behind. Creatures reborn in the dark depths of the oceans between the continents do not recognize each other. Mothers do not recognize their offsprings just after giving birth, and vice versa. They eat whatever falls into their mouths, and so must live by feeding on each other. Even the animals in the human realms eat each other. Hogs eat little birds. Birds eat worms. Beasts of prey and deer kills each other. Hunting dogs stalk deer and kill them, and so on. So we will stop here. It's almost 11:30. Thanksgiving mantle offering. Do not let him go.